Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Antique Auction Podcast. This is Martin Willis.
And Phyllis Gao. And today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast. And there are over 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod, iPhone, or MP3 player at audible.com.
Yes, and today's guest, I've heard his name for many years. We're pretty proud to have Don Triani. How are you doing?
Fine. Glad to be here.
Great. So right off the bat, a question that came to mind when I was thinking about you, looking at your beautiful artwork. Which came first, your fascination for military or your artwork?
It was pretty simultaneous. I mean, it started with the usual, stick figure drawings in kindergarten. And, around the third or fourth grade, my parents were interested in antiques, and there was plenty of stuff around. My father was a war veteran, and once I expressed an interest, the other war veterans that I know were giving me German helmets, and my father bought me a cavalry saber from the Civil War.
Oh, wow.
Then I wanted more, and, they would go to auctions all the time, and basically to keep me quiet. They'd buy me something once in a while.
Yeah, I think I grew up like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then, the more you get, the more you learn, and then you start to meet some other collectors, and you develop more of a direction rather than being a regular accumulator.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's true that your father's an artist, too?
Yeah, he was. Mm-hmm. He used to do commercial lettering and in the city, and then eventually got phased out by computers and mechanicals and went into the antique business with my mother.
Oh, I see.
Oh, wow. Now, you had formal art training, right?
Yeah, I went to the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Art and the Art Students League, but they don't teach much traditional stuff anymore. In fact, very little, at least when I went there in the late 60s and early 70s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I was pretty much on my own, about 90% self-taught.
Now, I've heard that your Civil War depictions are the truest to uniform of anyone else's work.
I'm doing more Revolutionary War now than Civil War, but my main field of interest has been in the study of uniforms, equipment, and weapons, of all those eras, and, what the jackets are made out of, the clothing is made out of, plus also the tailoring. I mean, the tailoring is totally different. I spent a lot of time having actual garments copied and recreated for the models to wear to get the period look. Otherwise, you can't.
You use live models in your work, is that right?
Yep, for every single figure.
Is that right?
Wow. Fully dressed and equipped, usually armed with original weapons.
Wow.
And but I've spent the last 35 years having copies of things made, Civil War trousers, and a friend of mine's a bootmaker at Colonial Williamsburg, and he's copying excavated boots off shipwrecks and using the patterns, and we make those, for the models, that kind of thing.
Wow. Now, are you talking about you have a fully posed battle scene? Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't do them all at once.
Oh, just parts?
Yeah, it might be one or two or three figures at a time.
And, I see.
Having models coming over in shifts over a few weeks. And then, constructing the whole thing from that.
Now,
I have a huge prop department. A reproduction clothing. I'm always getting new things made.
Uh-huh. Now, we have a mutual friend, John Arkebloom.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Great collector.
Yes, yeah. And he said he met you in Philadelphia, I believe.
Oh, maybe. I've known him since he was a young lad.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a great guy. He was on one of our podcasts way back.
He is, yeah.
Yeah. He said that you have a very large collection, one of the largest private collections. Is that right?
It's hard to say. It's pretty large. It's not as large as I would like it to be.
Mm-hmm.
But, it runs the gamut from about the French and Indian War up through World War II. With emphasis more on uniforms and headgear and accoutrements than, on guns and swords, although there's, a good number of them. And I even have a few cannons.
Wow.
Oh, wow.
Civil War and one Revolutionary War cannons, fully set up. And those also come in handy for the modeling.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you just store all of this in your house?
Well, I keep it in different places. Very secure areas, but mm-hmm. most of it's put away because it's just too much to put out.
Of course. But mm-hmm. I bet, so do you just live amongst all these artifacts? They're just...
There's a lot of it around, because I need to have, if I'm painting a sword hilt in a painting, it's a lot easier if you can just yank it off the wall and set it up next to the easel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you actively paint all the time?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That's my full-time occupation.
Okay.
I see. And do you do commissioned work?
It's primarily commissioned. Occasionally I'll do something because I feel like I want to do it. But mm-hmm. I'll get people who will come to me and they'll say, I want a painting of a Revolutionary War scene. What do you suggest? And then, of course, I can pick something I've always wanted to do. Or they have, a more specific idea. And I'll get commissions, from institutions. I just did one for the Army War College and another one for the Signal Corps Association.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying now to paint all the major battles of the Revolution. That's my next goal.
Oh, wow.
So about halfway there.
And you do a lot of, or you at least do some consulting work, I saw.
I've done it occasionally for museums and institutions and some appraisal work. I've done a lot of, for films. I don't do much anymore. I did a lot of these History Channel mm-hmm. stuff. And I did Cold Mountain.
Mountain.
So did
that
they,
was a great book, by the way, and a good movie.
Was it fun to consult, or do you feel that takes away?
Yeah, the bigger battle with doing these kinds of things, it's not what you have them do; it's what you prevent them from doing. The Europeans are a lot easier to work with, though, than the American film people, because the Americans aren't as concerned with authenticity, and the Europeans, if they hire you as a consultant, they have a tendency to listen to what you say. So if I say, well, this Massachusetts flag should be this, it should be this size, it's okay, and they just do it. The Americans don't listen too well.
Interesting.
Now, at least the ones I work with.
Where was Cold Mountain filmed?
Romania.
That's what I thought.
Oh,
it was.
Wow.
They used
the Romanian army. But it was the Italians who made all the stuff, the uniforms and the flags. And they did a really good job. Hmm. And the Romanian army looked really good because it was all young kids. They made them camp out there. In fact, the officers were beating them with sticks.
Oh, my gosh.
And they camped out there for the whole summer, to make these battle scenes, half of which they cut out of the film.
Oh.
Mm.
I went to the screening with Mihaela, and they cut out half an hour.
Mm.
But it was mostly action stuff, the Battle of the Crater and the Great Hospital we did. Mm. We really labored over that, to get even the surgical tools correct and everything.
Wow.
And it all went bye-bye.
Oh, really? That must have been a lot of fun. For what you do, I bet you really enjoyed it.
It sure was. I basically did it from the house. I mean, it's just a matter of emailing them the information, and I would dress models fully clothed to show them how the equipment should be worn. And so I'd do a front view of the model and a back view, for a Union infantryman, for an officer, and then all the different badges, for the right brigades and divisions that were, in the battle.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing with the Confederates, and they followed most of it. Some departments, the costume department listened very well, but like the horse equipment told us basically to go to hell, and they do it their own way, and that's why they've got all modern Dude Ranch saddles in the movie.
Oh,
wow.
Uh-huh.
So each department is a kingdom all its own.
Yeah, I noticed that, by the way.
Yeah, sure.
Well, that wasn't my fault.
So now, because of email, you didn't get to fly out to Romania. You must be pretty mad.
Well, I didn't want to go.
Oh.
It was a 2-hour drive. A friend of mine went and did the on-site work, and we would consult. He called and say, they're doing this. You got to tell them not to, whatever. And but it was a 2-hour ride over these dirt roads from the hotel every day to get out to the site. So I wasn't going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you're a very busy guy. I Googled you with quotations, no less, and 92,000 websites came up. So,
wow, that's not bad.
not too bad.
And you have a Wikipedia page, which pretty much means that you're a big deal.
Yeah.
That does it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about, why don't you tell us what other things you are involved in besides painting?
Well, I don't do it too much. I used to do a lot of digging for Revolutionary War artifacts.
Oh, wow.
I might start again. We spent a lot of time looking for the lost camps. There were a lot of encampments in the Hudson River winter camps.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, when you're looking for those kinds of things, the encampments are far better than any kind of battlefield. Because you've got a concentrated, you know, 1,000 or 1,200 mm-hmm. men, you know, living in the, you know, a formal winter camp for a whole winter or mm-hmm. two winters. Mm-hmm. And they used it again.
Like a dump site, too, would be pretty interesting.
Oh, I love dumps.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice trash pit, you can find one of those, and we found some good ones. Mm-hmm. I did a lot of digging in the Caribbean, too. You know, we would basically leave the wives at the hotel and search out the forts and barracks that were inland. And, you know, we got quite a bit of material. And a lot of the sites we used to dig are now shopping malls or things like that. I did a book on Revolutionary War buttons, which incorporated a lot of that information.
I heard that's the best book of its kind.
It's one of the only ones of its kind, but we're revamping it now and putting in buckles and everything else. I've got a co-author, Jim Cochin, and we're expanding that.
And you have a lot of publications, right? You've authored and you've illustrated some books too.
Yeah, on Civil War uniforms. There's mm-hmm. two on my artwork, and then I did one on Civil War uniforms and one on Revolutionary War uniforms and equipment, and the one on buttons. Mm-hmm. So I may do a few more, but I'm getting lazier as I get older.
So the examples of the buckles, a lot of those, I'm talking about Revolutionary.
Yeah.
A lot of those are dug pieces?
Yeah, the majority are.
Wow.
Basically, that's sort of the only way you can get them. But many have never been seen before because you'll get a relic hunter who's looking for coins up near Saratoga and finds one accidentally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I've just been accumulating pictures of those and talking to relic hunters for years and developed large files of all this unpublished stuff. It's never been concentrated in one spot.
Then
we're combining that with portraits of officers actually wearing these things and all the written accounts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, is this like an image bank? Did I see something like that?
Some of it's on there, not all of it. The image bank started out as different, you know, my paintings are licensed to books and magazines. You know, they'll want to use, say, Molly Pitcher at Monmouth, and they'll pay us a fee to use it. And they always wanted to see everything we had. So we started the image bank for my artwork, and then they asked for other things. Well, do you have a Civil War musket, or do you have a canteen? So I started putting things from my collection on there, then other people's collections, and then different museums' collections. And, you know, it's constantly growing. It's about 8,000 or 9,000 items now, artifacts.
Jeez.
Wow, that's great. Are you a dealer in these collectibles?
Not a full-time dealer. I'm like a collector that buys and sells. If I buy a collection of items, of six items, there might only be one thing I want for my collection, so I'll sell the other five, and it pays for the sixth one.
Mm-hmm.
The item that I keep, it also pays for all the newspaper ads, sometimes.
Sure. Now, do you find that, how do you feel the market is right now for, let's just focus on, like, Civil War items? What's the market like these days?
It's pretty soft. Civil War cloth. Clothing, uniforms, and headgear, I'd say, has dropped 50%.
Wow.
Sword, everything is soft. Some items, photography and buttons seem to be faring pretty well.
Mm.
Documents are still okay. Mm. Items with good histories, exciting histories, or connections with Gettysburg are still pretty strong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some items do very well on eBay. You know, they got a pretty good audience, almost better than at the big auction houses.
Hmm.
So you're pretty involved with eBay yourself, are you?
I sell, you know, the small stuff that I don't want on eBay.
Mm-hmm. I see.
It's a good way to get rid of it in 7 days, and you don't have to take it to a show or call up somebody, and you don't have to know what it's worth.
Uh-huh.
You just put it on there and let the market decide.
Yeah.
It's, sometimes you don't even have to know what it is.
Yeah, I mean, you have 300 million
people. You get some oddball gun part, and I'm not sure what it is, and I don't want to spend 3 days going through books to try and figure out what it is. I just put it on there and say it might be this, and the bidders know, and it just gets done.
Mm-hmm. Now, a former, this is a kind you might be interested in just knowing about this. A former colleague and friend of mine called me and said he had something interesting to show me, and he came over and he had some items from Lieutenant Purington, who was in the, Pritchard had sent him into Jeff Davis's camp and to catch him. You know, he caught him.
Oh.
And he has the button from the cloak and all the cavalry CVDs images, and as well as Pritchard's. So it's a nice little, it's a little time capsule all basically involved in the capture of Davis.
Those kind of things are pretty desirable, where they have a nice, interesting connection with history.
Mm-hmm.
But so in other words, you could have a rougher condition Union frock coat, but if the guy was wounded at Antietam and probably wearing the coat, it's more desirable than a mint example with no history.
Oh, wow.
You know, there's a lot more Civil War uniforms around than you'd think, and a lot of surplus ones that came as late as 1973. I got a 100 mint cavalry jackets.
Now, was that the ones that were
costume shop?
Wasn't there some Confederate uniforms that were never issued? They were just stored by somebody during the Civil War.
Well, there were a lot still in warehouses at the when the war ended. The Confederates were not as a ragtag and bobtail as you might think.
Mm-hmm.
The hard part was not getting them clothed; it was getting the clothing to them.
Right, and
especially if the army
supplies
the
in general.
You know, so if you have 100,000 uniforms sitting in a warehouse in North Carolina, it's a big job to get them up to Lee's army in Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Plus, North Carolina might hold the uniforms. Georgia might need them, but North Carolina wouldn't let Georgia have them, even if they have extras. There's a lot of states' rights junk going on at the same time.
Mm. Yeah, it seems to me I remembered something about that having to do with the governor or something hanging on to them.
If you look at the pictures of the dead Confederate soldiers taken at Petersburg, they're pretty well clothed. I mean, they all have shoes, they all have jackets, even the vests.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not ragged.
Mm-hmm.
A little dirty from the mud, but they weren't as bad off as you think in that respect. Probably food was a bigger issue.
Mm.
Right. Yeah, especially toward the end. I remember reading about how poor shape Lee's army was at the very end.
Oh, yeah. You know, they're on the move, too, so you can't get the supplies to them. You know, they're moving in a direction. There might not be railroad lines that are going to where they are, and that's the issue.
Mm-hmm. And the Union messed up as many railroad lines down there as they could, too.
They messed up a lot, but the Union military railroads were excellently run.
Mm-hmm.
And they had much more equipment, much more rolling stock, and great management.
Mm-hmm.
So supplies were not as much of an issue for the Union Army.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in fact, there's the fact that there were thousands, tens, hundreds of thousands of uniforms left over after the war. They were used for a long time into the Custer period.
Wow.
Yeah, it wasn't until 1872 that they adopted a new uniform. They were issuing leftover Civil War uniforms. They were giving them to Indians. They were giving them to prisoners in the federal prisons.
Is that right? So yeah. How you wouldn't be able to distinguish if you were buying, say, out of an estate, a Civil War uniform from something that was issued at a later time? You wouldn't really be able to distinguish
it. Well, you'd know what it was, but you couldn't tell, unless it had a name written in or something, you couldn't tell who had it or what.
Mm-hmm.
In 1872, they changed the uniforms to, you know, totally different style with different trimmings and so forth.
And I understand, and there's some European, possibly French, is it, that the uniforms look similar?
Well, they were copying the French. In fact, almost everybody copied the French. And the basic Civil War uniform is a copy of the French uniform, and before the Civil War, it's even closer. Mm. And you have regiments in the Zouave uniforms and Chasseurs. And, there was a French company that actually put out a bid. They were trying to equip the entire Union Army in French clothing, and they brought over 10,000 suits. The federal government brought them, but when they got here, they found out that the sizes were too small, and only three regiments got them.
Oh,
wow.
Strange.
They were for Frenchmen. They didn't fit. But, you know, they were giving them out for bands, and then what was left over was sold surplus after the war, and they show up occasionally. Very good-looking uniforms.
Are those desirable?
Somewhat. Collectors tend to want the more Main Street stuff in Civil War uniforms. The four-button blouse, which was the commonest outfit, Jack, they made millions of them during the war. It's actually the hardest one to find because it's made out of what you'd call shoddy, and the survival rate was really low. So the most common garment is the most desirable, and it's also the rarest.
Wow, when you say shoddy, what exactly do you mean?
Shoddy is just, it's cheesy material. It didn't last long. The trousers were made out of kersey, which was a much better, heavier material. But it's almost like a flannel, you know, like a loose flannel blouse. It wasn't expected to last too long, you know, theoretically a year, but I'm sure most of them in the field didn't even last that.
So it's just more or less biodegradable in a way.
Yeah, yeah.
Have you ever put on a uniform?
Yeah.
Are they comfortable?
You know, I used to do some reenacting in the old days.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But not since about 1980.
Are the uniforms generally pretty small for today's average American?
Some of them are. You know, I would say smaller sizes were certainly more common then, but occasionally you get somebody who's today's size. I mean, 5'8" was the minimum height for a British grenadier in the Revolution.
Oh, really?
You know, but there were a lot of 5'5" guys, and 5'3" was, you know, pretty common. You know, a lot of it was bad diet. But there were plenty of six-footers in the Civil War.
Is that right? Wow. I understand that when they did the reenactments all the way back in the 1960s, some people made the clothing so accurate that it's really difficult to tell because of the age.
I'd say that's happening now more today than then. In the 60s, they were actually wearing original things in the reenactment, some of them, because you could buy a Civil War cavalry jacket for $10.
Is that right?
So it was easy just to go out and ruin that than have one made. But they do make some really good stuff now, but the really good stuff only comprises maybe 2 or 3% of what's being made for the reenactors. Reenactors come in all shades of gray, with maybe 5% being really accurate, and then the rest run from there to terrible in you know, varying scale.
Now, one of the things that we had talked about when we spoke with John Archibloom is the fakes. Since things have gone down a little bit in value, do you see less fakes, or is it still?
No, well, all the old ones are still there.
Yeah, they're still floating around.
Yeah, they didn't go away. No, the faking is huge. World War II is the worst. Virtually every single thing is faked, and a lot of it comes out of Eastern Europe.
Wow.
Are you talking about, what, the medals and pins and everything?
Everything. You can get, let's say there'll be a rare German helmet. It could be a fake from scratch, with every single part of it faked, or a combination of fake and original items. Or they'll take an original plain one and put excellent fake insignias on and paint it camouflage to be very rare, and then age it. And you can tell by looking at them, but some of them are really close. I mean, some of them are really good. In some cases now, the decals are so good that you can only check them by X-ray fluorescent technology, you know, where you put the X-ray gun and it'll tell you the components, because the decals made during World War II are different from the ones made afterwards. Same thing with testing the paint.
Right.
But even $10 items are faked. In Civil War, the Confederate items are the worst. The belt buckles, you know, because they're brass castings. They fake them, they age them, they know exactly how to do it, and it's a big problem. As a matter of fact, they're finding out that many plates that have been sold by authorities now are no good.
Wow.
And haven't been for years. they're not the right size. When you make a casting from something else, you lose about 2%. And they're starting to measure them, but they're also finding out that, you know, the fakery was even worse than everybody thought. But you can take an original coat and write a fake name in it, or a real name, or that's almost the bigger issue. The uniform is hard to fake from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll take an original coat and then write a name in or put other things with it and pretend that this is the commission and all these things go with it to create a more valuable set.
Mm-hmm.
Or take an original sword and engrave a fake name on it.
Oh, really?
So the best fakes are the ones that have the least amount of fakery.
Mm-hmm.
So everything else is original, mm-hmm. except maybe just the inscription.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that must be awful frustrating. I mean, fakes are frustrating for everyone, but for someone like you, you probably spend a lot of useless time because of a fake, don't you?
No. You know, 95% of the fakes are really easy to spot.
Really?
Uh-huh. Probably half of the military stuff on eBay or more is a fake.
Mm.
But it's a ludicrous fake. It's to fool novices who, you know, are the largest part of the buying market. Then you've got a 5%, let's say, of really good fakes. But cost-wise, it's easier. There's less work involved in creating a pretty good fake to fool a novice than you're spending a huge amount of time to try and fool an expert.
Mm-hmm.
So
I see exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm.
So
the word to the wise to a novice collector is to buy from someone that knows what they're selling.
Well, you know, you'll pay more, but you aren't basically going to go to a flea market and buy a rare Confederate buckle. I mean, the chances are 1 in 1,000. It can happen.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the chances are more likely you're going to get nailed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I've seen...
Because the flea markets are well-folded with military fakes.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Over the years, I've seen many buckles, and when I was back in New England, I used to bring them in to John, and right away, it's John Archibald, right away, he'd say, nope.
Yep.
You know? It was mostly nope.
So there's auctions, no offense, but auctions are a great way to get rid of fakes, too. I mean, the collector will try everybody he can on it. When there's no takers, then you throw it in an auction and see if it sticks. There's a lot of that. And then if it doesn't sell at that auction, it'll be in another auction in another part of the country. It's sort of like musical chairs until it winds up with somebody taking it for a while.
Yeah, they were doing that with the fake mechanical banks for years. You know.
I mean, you know, it's pretty pervasive, and it's always been there, it'll always be there, and mm-hmm. you just have to keep learning and try and keep ahead of the latest fakes.
Mm-hmm. So, Don, did you have a mentor in the business, or did you have to learn the hard way what was fake and what
was? Pretty much the hard way, but you develop a circle of other collectors that you know, and it becomes mm-hmm. a shared knowledge. So mm-hmm. if I'm a little weak on a piece of insignia, it's not my specialty, but I like it, I can call up, you know, the top collector for that who really knows it better than I and say, what do you think of this? Mm-hmm. You develop, and you know, a lot of times, too, I can call up so-and-so and say, I'm being offered this sword, and you'll go, well, I remember when Joe Blow had it 12 years ago, and it didn't have a belt with it.
Oh.
Uh-huh. So there's a lot of... sort of verbal pedigree that people know items that have been in circulation and have seen it earlier on or even photographed it.
Mm-hmm.
So you can eliminate, you know, a lot of items like that.
Okay.
You can eliminate about another 25% just by who's selling it.
Oh.
And if it's somebody with an unsavory reputation, I just don't deal with them, period. That eliminates a lot of problems because you're rarely going to outsmart them.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to watch yourself at all times. That's basically what it boils down to. Provenance is also good when it's available.
Oh, yeah. That really is disturbing to hear that they're faking just $10 items when it comes to World War II.
Yeah, there's absolutely no safe area. I mean, even a $5 U.S. patch can have a fake, and you have to blacklight it, and you have to... You know how it's stitched on the front and the back, both, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Jeez.
There's no safe haven, there's no shelter, there's no nothing.
Yeah.
Although Revolutionary War buttons are rarely faked.
Yeah, I'm sure, because they're so rare, first of all. And did I see you have a loyalist pieces as well?
Yeah. I like loyalist stuff when you can find it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's amazing.
It's not that often.
Mm-hmm.
But the buttons are, they're almost a safe haven. That's not too bad. Although you have to watch out for ones they repair with, like epoxy filler.
Oh.
The pewter ones.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
But black light will usually pick that up.
Yeah.
Unless they rub it with like UV protector.
Oh,
it's
wow.
It's a way around everything. Jeez. Isn't there?
Never even thought of that.
There's always something.
How about the wooden Civil War canteens? Has anyone ever tried to fake those?
No, they're
be
kind
very
of too
difficult.
Hard to make.
I know. I was just thinking the construction of those is very intense.
I have a few reproduction ones that one guy made. He did a really good job, but even still, they don't look like the real ones. I mean, they're close, and they're fine for artwork, but they wouldn't fool you. And a lot of people are worried about the fake inscriptions on them, the carving, but there's not too much of that either, because you're ruining an already desirable item if you don't do the carving just right. It's like on the Revolutionary War guns, fake regimental markings on the barrel, can double the value on a Revolutionary War British musket, but it's almost impossible to do it right, and if you screw it up, you're reducing the value by two-thirds or so. So there isn't too much of that. It's more likely if they take a barrel off one gun and put it on another one, that's more of a concern.
This is kind of a nutty question, but has anyone ever tried to fake from scratch a daguerreotype?
I think they do it. I don't do too much with photography, but you'll get some reenactors or things like that. Who'll pose for them, and some of them look very good. And they'll create scenes, but I don't do too much with photography. There's a lot of laser copying of photographs and things like that, and they usually wind up on eBay, for carte de visites. So forth. You have to watch that. They'll take a carte de visite, and they'll peel off an uninteresting thing off the backing. So they've got the back mark, and then they'll put a new laser image and glue that on the face.
So that
whole card is mounted on it, everything looks perfect, but the image is no good.
So even though eBay is a great place to find things, someone really has to be careful, it sounds like.
Well, you can't pick it up and look at it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
There's a lot more of that going on, even with auction houses now, because everything's online. So you're bidding at an auction in California, and if you don't examine the item in person, you're taking a much bigger chance.
Right.
I always try and have a friend go out, and look at the item, or make sure I can get a return if there's a problem. If you read a lot of the auction, catalog terms, there is no return, basically. So you have to be really careful with that.
Yeah. I used to say that I would never buy anything that I couldn't handle. But the way things have changed, it's like... everything's changed. You know what I mean?
I agree, because occasionally I'll buy items. But if you have enough good pictures, a lot of times, it's a field you really know, you can be pretty safe.
Do either of you guys know anyone who collects from wars after post-World War II?
They do collect Korean and Vietnam stuff, but I don't really do anything with that. Too close, I almost got into the Vietnam thing, so I don't... I limit myself to 1945 is my cutoff date.
But they do, actually. I wonder if they even do the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
You never know.
I think there's a little of that going on, but the Vietnam stuff is pretty collectible, and some of that can go for pretty strong money, especially some of the rare kinds of camouflage suits and some of the rare patches. And I know they're faking it.
Are they really?
Yeah.
Of course. Jeez.
Is there a certain area in the world where all the fakes are concentrated in, or is it all over the place?
It depends. I mean, most of your Confederate belt buckles are going to come out of the South. The World War II stuff, a lot of that comes out of Eastern Europe, Latvia, Estonia, Russia, a little bit out of Russia, Poland, all over there. But we make some here, too. And, of course, the Chinese are involved in some of it. I know they're faking samurai swords in China. The first generation aren't too good, but they keep getting better and better. And of course, they're heavy with U.S. coins. They're faking those like crazy in China.
Really?
And there could be a point where you might not be able to tell the fake from the real one. From what I understand, they're getting pretty close.
So I heard that during the Civil War, the Confederate counterfeiters would get caught because their work was too good.
Yeah, it could be. They were faking Confederate war relics in New York during the war. Battle flags and Bowie knives. There was a factory in New York making them, and they would give them to people to sell. Hey, here's a Confederate flag I captured at Bull Run, and somebody would give them $10 for it, which is big money.
Wow.
And, you wonder how many of those are around in collections that were actually made in New York and never were in the South, because they're going to be perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect materials, perfect age, everything, except it's a period fake.
Mm-hmm. Jeez.
They were faking World War II German items as early as 1946.
A year after the war.
Yeah, the Germans started.
That's something.
They sold it to the GIs who were there.
Maybe you should write a book about fakes next, Don.
Oh, God, it would be too huge. I can tell you some stories. You wouldn't believe the amount of fakery that's going on. Somebody will find a knife set, and it'll say presented by Joe Blow to President Lincoln. Mm-hmm. But the knife set's all beat up, and it has a nice silver plaque. Well, the next thing you know, that plaque's on a gun. So you've got an original plaque, got an original gun. It's just that the two pieces don't go together, and you really got to look and see that they do go together.
This is very complicated.
Those are the most dangerous kinds of fakes, because it's an assemblage of original little components.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's sad. I mean, it would have been perfectly fine separate, right?
Yeah. Well, it's a guilty till proven innocent way you have to look at things.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm. Pretty much. It's a dangerous game, and you can get burned if you don't. Usually, when you don't follow your instinct, is when you get it.
Now, when you're collecting, where are the different? Do you buy in different areas of the country, or what do you do?
I tend to buy mostly up in New England, because that's where I am. I prefer to buy directly from families and estates as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Then, secondly, by old collections, and then collectors I trust, like John Ockerbloom, who might have gotten something out of a nice estate that I want that he doesn't want, and occasionally from a dealer or an auction if it's something I want, but not as much.
Now, we're getting toward the end of our time here, but let me just ask you a couple things. If someone wanted to buy your artwork, or are you in a gallery? Or galleries?
I have one gallery, Alterman Gallery, in Santa Fe. But they can come to me direct.
Okay. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Great.
Well, then I don't have to pay the gallery commission.
Hooray.
Should I edit that out?
No.
No. Okay. So
I take commissions, and they can come to me directly.
Okay. And how does someone find you?
Email or by telephone is fine. Chainshot@AOL.com.
Chainshot@AOL.com. Just how it sounds.
Yep.
And why don't you throw out one of your websites?
www.historicalartprints.com. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, did the Image Bank, is that a separate, your?
That's www.historicalimagebank.com.
Oh, very good.
And that shows all the artwork, but nothing on that site is for sale. It's just, like an archive.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that's military artifacts and artwork.
So when you say you take commissions, so let's say Martin Willis right next to me, he wants to be painted in...
I'm looking a little bit like General Lee, actually, with my beard here.
If he wants to be in real Civil War uniform and painted, would you be able to do that for him?
I probably wouldn't do it.
I'm not taking it personally.
If you wanted to, let's say Lee at Antietam, I would do that, but I generally don't do, kind of thing where you want yourself dressed up in a uniform kind of thing.
That's too bad.
I could say it was my ancestor.
But we make limited edition prints out of a lot of this, too, so I always try and pick subjects that will make a good print also.
That's pretty smart, yeah. So
you want to get, you know, as much use out of everything as possible, so if it's a desirable subject, mm-hmm. you know, that helps, too. But, you know, I'm always taking commissions. I have three or four right now, so.
Well, I think that it feels like we just scratched the surface with you, but it's been a real pleasure, Don.
Anytime at all.
Thank you.
Happy.
Yes.
And I'll look forward to hearing it.
It was very informative. Thank you.
Yes. So this is Martin Willis.
And Phyllis Gall.
And we're signing
off.
Today's podcast was brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at audiblepodcast.com/auctionpodcast. I'd recommend Cold Mountain, very good book. There are over 75,000 titles to choose from for your iPod, iPhone, or MP3 player. Thank you, and I hope you enjoyed today's show.